HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 204, recorded live Tuesday, March 9th, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with social media consultant Liz Burr.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting down today with Liz Burr. Liz is a new media consultant, an entrepreneur, and a blogger, and I've actually met Liz from Twitter, and I thought it would be interesting to bring her on the show because most of us who are listening are programmers or people who are involved in technology, but Liz is involved in what is called basically new media consultancy. Thank you, Liz, for taking the time to chat with me.
Hi.
So you're a new media consultant, or maybe would you call yourself a social media consultant?
Well, social media is definitely a part of it. I do other things. I mean, I used to be a front-end developer and designer, and so I kind of know how to build a product from concept to final product. And, you know, I assist my clients from, you know, their ideas through the whole project management aspect to final product. And so some of that entails social media because that's a little bit of marketing. And, you know, other things, I check code to see if people are, if their developers are building crappy code or, you know, I do a lot of QA work. So I kind of do a lot of different things. So social media is a different part of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went to MIT and you have a background in what MIT calls comparative media studies. Mm-hmm. Did this comparative media studies degree prepare you for a job in new media consultancy?
Yes. I mean, the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT used to be called Film and Media Studies when I first got there, and then it kind of morphed into comparative. So there I studied things like music, film, television, books, theater, all kinds of things across the board. And, of course, digital studies is definitely an important part of that. I'm feeling a little old because we didn't talk that much about the web. When I was at MIT, we were in the middle of the first the internet boom or whatever. And so social media things hadn't come around. But what I liked about my degree program and a little bit why it helps me today is that my classes were all new classes. You know, like the classes that I took or many of the classes that I took hadn't been around for very long. And I loved to take all the new classes that were there. And I think in some ways that helped keep me interested in, you know, what's coming on the horizon. And that's definitely what I do today as a new media consultant. Things that I tell my clients that to do today are not things that I would have advised them to do 2 or 3 years ago. So, you know, I think in some ways it helped. In other ways, you don't necessarily need a CMS degree from MIT. Definitely not. There's so many people who don't have any type of background in media studies who do this. So, yeah.
And I personally have MIT issues, and mostly it's envy. I visited MIT in the early 90s and decided that it wasn't for me. But I think of MIT as being somewhere with a certain amount of rigidity. And, you know, it has a reputation of being, you know, pretty hardcore. And as a person looking outside, you know, looking into MIT, I would think that there would be a great deal of formalism, and I guess, you know, again, rigidity is the word that comes to mind. And I think of people at MIT, you know, programming and doing hard analytics. So when I think of something like a media studies degree and then applying that to the field of new media, it feels kind of like what I call the soft skills as opposed to the hard skills. Like you can't compile a new media program, a new media, you know, PR plan and say, oh yeah, there are no errors. This will run.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that I learned in my degree program was a lot of theory. And I say that jokingly, because I got my master's degree at USC. And so I learned a lot of theory in college, but I didn't learn a lot of things that I could apply in terms, at least in terms of new media and, the internet, I think. And part of that has to do, I think, through my own initiative. I just didn't have a lot of initiative when I was an undergrad because MIT was really hard and there were just so many other things. I mean, even though I took kind of what sounds like these fluff classes, I started out as a biology major and, you know, I was doing research in chemistry labs and all kinds of stuff. And every MIT student has to go through a hard science core. So, I think for me at the time, I probably could have tried out some things that were more application heavy. But, at the time I was a little bit all over the place just because I wanted to make sure that science wasn't what I wanted to do. And I was definitely more into humanities and history and social and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Is the formalism and the hard science applied to social media and new media?
You know, I kind of have a hard issue with this at times. Yes, there's of course. I mean, I definitely do lots of analytics and closing reports with my clients when we do campaigns or certain initiatives in terms of looking at analytics. But at the same time, I see people who report these analytics too, and I'm not necessarily 100% convinced that they actually mean anything. It's like, you know, so you have a tweet that you sent out that reached 120,000 people. Did 120,000 people actually read that? And can you make that analogous to 120,000 people seeing your billboard, you know, down the street? So sure, there's definitely a way to measure things, but in terms of measuring how important those things are to people who see them, we're not necessarily at that point yet where we can make guarantees.
See, that's one of the things that I struggle with because in my job, one of the things that we track is how many people that I touch, how many people that I come in contact with. But it's difficult to measure the quantity of that touch. I mean, breadth is an interesting measurement, but it's only interesting for a few minutes, and it's really very superficial.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, for me, that's why I wanted to get a master's degree. I have a master's degree from USC, Journalism School, and online communities. And so that helps me in the sense of learning how people measure things either from a quantity or qualitative point of view. And to some extent, I like to, you know, of course I have quantitative results, but I also do qualitative analysis of the data. And, you know, the other issue I think is that the medium changes so fast. And so, you know, Twitter has so many different features now than it had a year ago, you know, versus 2 years ago. And it's like, the way people engage with things on Twitter are constantly changing. So you have to change the way you measure something qualitatively as well.
Sometimes when I think about a new media consultant, I think of like the preppy guy that I didn't get along with in high school. And I always think about like, you know, he had nicer clothes and he would always take his sweatshirt and like wrap it around his waist. And it seems like the nerds became programmers and the popular preppy people became new media consultants.
Right. I mean, I honestly think that a lot myself, and it's strange because I feel, you know, in my self-loathing. I mean, I definitely think some of that is rampant online, at least. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, I just try to keep, you know, I'm not one of those people who's, I guess, always campaigning about myself because I don't necessarily want to come off as that person because I see those people all the time who are, you know, very good at selling themselves, but don't necessarily have any type of hard skills that they learned anywhere. And, you know, that's fine. I'm not hating on them, but I just don't want to be perceived as that person. So I'm very mm-hmm. careful about how I market myself, what I say about myself, because, yeah, I totally don't want to be that person.
Well, how does one market themselves as a new media consultant? I mean, I could see if I'm hiring you, I think, and I don't know much about social media, that I would go on Twitter and I would say, well, hey, Liz, you only have 3,000 followers. You know, this other dude has 150,000. Maybe I should go with that guy.
Right. I mean, I often tell people, if they want to go with that guy, then go with that guy. But if you want to talk to me and I can tell you about myself, then that's perfectly fine. There's definitely enough of us to go around. I think a lot of my clients, that I have no idea like how important Twitter is in that sense. Like, they might look at followers, but some of them don't even get that far. Some of them don't go to my profile. I definitely don't always talk about social media on my profile. I talk about so many random things.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also don't understand that someone with 100,000 followers could have 100,000 people who aren't listening to them. So, and that I think happens a lot on Twitter. You know, everyone has a certain amount of share of voice. And so we don't even know what those numbers are, you know. So if I have 100,000 followers, does that mean that 7.25% of them are listening to me? Or is that person's percentage smaller or larger than the people that listen to me? And then what's the level of influence? And so, I think for many of my clients, they're not even on Twitter at that point. And they come to me to help them to get on Twitter.
So when a client comes to you, what kind of problem do they have? And why isn't a classic marketing or PR firm handling it? And then what is that problem they have? And then how are you solving it?
Well, most of my clients tend to be either bloggers or news and opinion sites or people with small businesses. So I have a different range, because when I say bloggers, these are people who have like 1.2 million pages a day, and it's a blog, but it's a very large blog. Or, you know, it's a news site that it's not just, you know, two people working on a website, they have a whole staff of like 15. So, but then again, I have like a small mom and pop, you know, restoration company in New Jersey who knows nothing about the internet, but they know that they need a presence. So people come to me either if they need a new website and they don't know where to start, or they come to me if they have a new website idea and they have money. They don't have a lot of money, but they have, you know, a considerable amount of money. So, you know, I've worked on sites that cost $300,000 to produce, and some of my clients might have that much money, but they don't want to spend that much money on a new site. So then, you know, they might have, let's say, $20,000, and they want to stretch that as far as they can. And I think for me, I like to sell the most of my value is to get a client the best that they can for their money, because agencies have a lot of overhead. And I think sometimes they will charge you a lot of money for, you know, somewhat, they'll be beautiful sites, but they may not be sites that you can kick around or that will be very lasting or that have very strong SEO. And I think for me, as a former front-end developer, I can look at code and I can tell you, no, this is very crappy code. Like, this isn't tables. This is horrible. Or, you know, I could say, you know what, you have way too many div layers in this, you know, on your code, and you need to improve these and use H1 tags instead. And so some of my clients, they'll often find freelance developers because that's what's cheaper for them, but they don't necessarily know if that freelance developer is as good as the money that they have for them. So I kind of come in to be like, yes, this is a good person. No, this is a good person. Or no, this is a bad person. Or, you know, I'll tell them, this is, you need a person with this type of skill set, you know, as a server admin. And that's kind of like the flexibility and the value that I have to offer for many of my clients.
Do you find that most of the social media people that you bump into in the circles that you run in are former developers?
No, not at all.
Are they just smooth talkers?
I think they're smooth talkers. And you know what? I definitely will admit that I am not a smooth talker. And it's definitely one of my faults, I think. I don't want to be a super smooth talker, but, you know, I don't think I market myself as well as I could. Part of that might be because I'm shy, or I have very high expectations for myself. And I don't want to lie to people and tell them something that I'm not, or something that I'm not 120% sure that I am. And so, you know, I do find that a lot of people don't have any technical chops, and, you know, they're kind of talking about a lot of theory or regurgitating things that they've read online. And, you know, it's not bad to read online, but, it, you know, read what you see online, but then also apply that to, you know, what you have to offer as well. Don't just copy it and then try to make a quick buck off of somebody.
Mm-hmm. So a shy social media consultant, but I'm looking at a picture here of you on stage at South by Southwest Interactive, on what looks like a panel of some kind.
Yes. I was on a panel last year, where I talked about, can black bloggers survive in the age of Obama? The thing about me is that I also started blogging really early, and that's, and well, 2002, and it was just kind of early for most people. And that's actually incidentally how I learned how to code and also the kind of stuff and turn it into a hobby, into a career, et cetera, et cetera. So Black bloggers online have definitely had a presence, but a lot of times, I would say until maybe the last 2 years, nobody really paid attention to them. So yeah, that was our panel last year at South by Southwest. And I was shy then. I'm going to South by Southwest this week, and I will continue to be shy.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman from another parallel universe. Got to tell you about some of our things our sponsors are doing. They make this free podcast possible. If you're developing a new line of business application, you've probably tried the latest version of Silverlight. Now you can get even better results by combining the functionality in Silverlight 4 beta with some of the richness of the third-party controls from our friends at Telerik. They're the first vendors to offer native support for the Silverlight 4 beta and their RAD controls. They've got a new Silverlight 4 CTP suite of these controls. They let you tap into the framework's great potential. You get native right mouse click and all the new features of Silverlight. There's 38 controls that give you all these features. You can start building those compelling line of business applications right away. I encourage you to check those products out at Telerik.com/Silverlight. And, thank Telerik for supporting .NET Rocks, supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page at Facebook.com/Telerik. Now back to the show.
So what is South by Southwest? I mean, everyone I follow on Twitter is going. People are asking me why I'm not going. This is a music festival that turned into some kind of a Scoble thing, or what are y'all doing? I'm just trying to get my head. I mean, I'm having you on the show so I can get my sense about what are you all doing down there?
Yes. I've been reading about South by Southwest Interactive, probably for about 5 years online. So all the bloggers that I used to love back in the day used to go, and they'd have all these reports, and I'd be like, oh, I really want to go. Back then, I wanted to go because I was a developer and a designer, and they had a lot of really good panels from people that I followed in the industry who were on panels. And so I thought it would be great just to kind of absorb the knowledge. And I like going to conferences in general. So that's originally my interest came from that. But then I saw kind of like the Black bloggers that I followed started talking about race and identity, and they had panels at South by Southwest. And so that was another interesting thing for me as well. So lately, I mean, I kind of think of it as like a nerd spring break. And it's like all of your friends that you've met online over the past year, over the past few years, meet at South by Southwest. And they say it's a big time for networking and all kinds of stuff, but me being a shy person, I'm not big on networking, but I am big on connecting with the people that I've met online in real life. In addition, I used to work for a PBS station here in Los Angeles, and I had a lot of coworkers that I met with my station as well as PBS headquarters, and so they come as well. And so for me, it's a great place to see old coworkers, people I went to grad school with, as well as my new friends. And honestly, I wasn't going to go this year because I was kind of a little annoyed with the guy with the sweater who was like too cool. And I felt that I didn't want to see, I see those people online all the time. I didn't want to have to pay money to see them in person. But, once I realized that, there's a lot of people going every year that I've met online, I want to see those people in person. And it's fun. It's fun to see the panels. It's fun to meet people and just kind of experience Austin. So.
One of the things that you brought up was that you were meeting Black bloggers, and you're biracial. You're half Black and half Navajo. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And one of the things, of course, my wife is Black, and I'm steeped in Black culture, and I spent a lot of time studying African American studies in college, and that was kind of the direction I was going to go before I went with software, actually. But it was just kind of a whole other show. But one of the things right. that I don't think the average white folks on Twitter understand is that Black people really love social media. Like black folks are 13-14% of the population, but what are the stats right now? It's like 30%.
It's really high. I mean, I'm not entirely sure where they all came from, because when I started online, it was like the wild, wild west. Like when I first started my blog, I mainly sought out people of color to connect with, because I didn't have a lot of them in my everyday life to connect with. And the same thing happened when I joined Twitter in 2007. I mostly followed Black people because at that time, the Black people on there were mostly tech people like me. And so it was great to connect with people of similar career or hobby interests that were also of color, just because you're not used to seeing them all the, you know, in your everyday life. But now, it's very different. I was reading this article in Ad Age a few weeks ago, and it was just talking about how not only are Black people probably in their 20s taking over Twitter, but they happen to be very good at internet memes, because you've seen those trending topics.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, people don't realize that the trending topics appear to be pretty much handled by young, predominantly Black, plugged-in people. I mean, I don't think it's representative. I mean, this is the part I don't realize, right? I don't understand. Is it representative of actual trending topics, or is it skewed with a more, more urban audience?
Probably trending topics, but I think that what the younger African American demographic using them, they're kind of obsessive with it. Like if I see a trending topic, I might tweet about that topic 3 times tops. And I may not even use a hashtag. But I have definitely friends in this demographic, and they will ride this hashtag out. They will like produce 30 to 40 tweets about this one topic in the span of like 45 minutes. So, you know, I think they might be, you know, a little bit more into it, I think, than everyone else. I think when trending topics first came out, you know, everyone was using it, you know, just to weigh in once or twice. But I don't think that, I don't know, I think it's, this demographic might be really into participating in memes, probably more so than the average user for a different type of trending topic.
You know, and I think this thing about being obsessive is a really interesting thing, because this is a group of people, and I don't mean Black folks, but I mean obsessive young people that I think may not be served appropriately by social media, and they're abusing the system, but they're sitting on the system. People, yes. Let me put it this way: people think that I tweet way too much. Like, if you ask my followers, they'd be like, Scott, you have a problem. Okay.
Yeah.
But I started, I don't know, something like May of 2007. I just hit 20,000 tweets yesterday. 20,000.
Oh,
you know.
That's not bad.
So I hit 20,000, right? I know people on Twitter who are 60, 70, 80,000, and they started last year. I know one particular individual who I think you know as well, who has 3 or 4 accounts, so that when she is limited, not by the API count of Twitter, but by Twitter saying you've tweeted too much, she has what are called jail accounts. So it's so-and-so in jail, so-and-so's lawyer, so-and-so's lawyer in jail. And she asks her followers to follow these other people so that when Twitter shuts her down, again, not from API calls, this is a different limit. This is the too many tweets too fast. That you follow her additional, and this is not just one individual. This is becoming a thing. People are using Twitter as IRC.
Yes.
Right. This is chat, and they don't realize. And I think it may be these obsessive individuals who are making it the real time search of Twitter pretty much useless, because it's pretty high high noise, low signal. What do you think?
I think one of the great things about social media is that, and part of it is also applied to the internet, is that there are no rules that come in. And so your limits are pretty much as limiting as the application can be, or in the case of your example, the girl with multiple, or the person with multiple accounts, as limiting as your imagination can be. And so, you know, of course, that type of behavior to me is useless, but they find value in it somehow. And I have a friend who is of this demographic, and I have her going to my phone, because I only have a certain amount of people whose tweets go to my phone as a text message. And I swear when she gets on, I have to go on and put her on pause, because she will just run up my whole text on my phone for the next 30 minutes. And it's great. I love her. So I'm not going to unfollow her. But I can imagine if I was following like 50 people just like her, it would drive me insane.
So when it comes time to to market to someone who's that savvy? Is it even possible? I mean, this is the thing. You're supposed to go out as a consultant and think about new ways to effectively either sell to or message, the masses. But the masses are incredibly sophisticated, and something that you used once may never work again.
Right. I think part of what I have to do, and this isn't even like billable time, but things that I do is I have to stay on top of how the market is changing and what's changing about features on whatever site, whether that's Facebook and their privacy controls or Twitter and, you know, their API changes. I think, you know, so anyone who's a new media consultant now, if they're not on top of their game, they can't necessarily stay a new media consultant for many years just because, unless they're doing something to stay on top of their game. I think you also have to stay on top of what, you know, how people are using it. And so that demographic that we're just talking about, one of my clients totally feeds off of that demographic. And so for me, it's great because, you know, I've had this client for about 2 years now, and I'd say about 2 years ago, they weren't even thinking about Twitter at all. So if I had tried to pitch them a Twitter strategy, they would have been like, oh, well, I don't want to devote any resources to that right now because my demographic's not there. But now they're totally on top of it, and I'm totally getting like more business from them across, you know, many of their sites because they're like, no, we need to tap into that demographic ASAP. But, you know, I can't control whether or not, you know, tomorrow they decide or, you know, this demographic moves on to another another site, and then I have to control them from there as well.
I was reading on your blog that you had noticed something that the actor and singer Tyrese had done, and you kind of juxtaposed his initial kind of pathetic attempt at Twitter to something that he'd done kind of recently. Could you talk a little bit about how he has learned how to use Twitter and what you think about that?
Yeah, okay, so I'd say maybe about a year or a year and a half ago, I can't remember, but I was following MC Hammer, and at the time I saw Tyrese jump onto MC Hammer's Twitter account and say, follow Tyrese right now. And at the time, I was like, you know, I like Tyrese, I like his music, but I don't like, he sounds like a jerk coming on MC Hammer's account and demanding people to follow him. It was just very odd. And so I checked out his Twitter feed, and it wasn't that exciting either. So I decided not to follow him. You know, I might check in on people every now and then, but I wasn't going to follow him continually. So I realized a week ago, I was reading one of the popular gossip blogs, and they had mentioned that he had done a Valentine's Day Twitter campaign. And so I checked it out, and it was one of the like most interesting campaigns I've probably seen from, I'd say, this circle. What Tyrese did is he had a Valentine's Day contest where he wanted people to nominate single mothers who were in the L.A. area for Valentine's Day date. And I think he ran this for a few days on his Twitter account, and he had 1,100 single mothers who were entered into the contest, and he picked 14 of them, and he brought them to the day spa in Beverly Hills, and you know, just treated them to a nice day of spa stuff like massages and pedicures and stuff, and he videotaped the whole thing and, you know, had it cut and put it on YouTube, and you know, I thought it was a really good example of how someone could really run a strong Twitter contest. You know, even though 1,100 people were participating, I don't know how many followers he had, but people were definitely reading about this. And I thought what was great is that it didn't seem like he was selling anything. Like, he wasn't trying to get people to go to this spa. From the video, you kind of get the impression that he paid for this. So it wasn't also that he had some sort of deal with a spa, because usually when you see something like this online, it's, you know, some brand or some company cutting people a deal to kind of create this campaign. And, you know, it's a pony show. But, you know, he was just being a nice person, it seemed. And, you know, I thought that was great. He was just being himself. And for me, that felt like, you know what, I might want to follow him now because he seems like, you know, not a jerk like I first had the impression of him. And, you know, he seems interested in trying to help people out. So, yeah, Tyrese did a very good job. His Twitter name is
Would you
Tyrese
say that, that was his goal then? That as a personality, as a as an actor and as a singer, his goal is to engender good feelings? And like what he is selling is himself. So now that you've slightly changed your opinion of Tyrese as being kind of a pompous jerk, and oh, that was very nice, you know, that that he has officially sold you something?
Yeah, he has. And I mean, I really like spas, so I might check out this place that I went to. I had to like rewind the tape to get the name because he didn't even pub the name of the spa. The other thing is that, you know, Tyrese is like the good looking singer slash actor. So of course he wants to like, you know, play to the ladies a little bit. So I think he was, you know, he wasn't like giving free dates to men or anything like that. Or, you know, it was definitely kind of to get women in their soft spots. And so I think that's part of his brand in general. So without having to sell me some brand outright, he definitely sold me on Tyrese, the person who is good for women.
Do you think that there is a Liz Burr who is working for Tyrese who made that decision? Or do you think Tyrese stumbled on this himself?
You know, I think it might be a mixture. And what I've been seeing with celebrities online, at least African American urban celebrities, is that they have these interesting ideas. They don't necessarily have all the tools to put everything together. And so I think, you know, Tyrese in general, like his episode with the MC Hammer thing, I think he was interested in Twitter. He just didn't know exactly what he needed to do to kind of not appear to be a jerk. And so he learned over time, you know, what was the right thing to do. Or he had someone clue him in, someone like me, who would clue him in on what to do. And so it was the same thing. No, I think a lot of these types of celebrities have someone who's like the nerd of the group. It might just be their friend, who's kind of like, you know, puts on the social media or new media consultancy hat and helps them, you know, put the pieces together. But I think, you know, it, to me, it seems like he had this idea of his own and then had people kind of help him put it together. I just don't know how he would put together, like, who's reading all these entries and emails. And so for me, that's something that I do for my clients. Like, they have a cool contest idea. I'm the one who, like, finds through all the entries and then finds the winner, you know? So I don't think Tyrese is doing that whole process, but there's someone there definitely helping him out.
It's amazing to me that somebody with a couple of million bucks in the bank probably has a, like you said, the nerd of the entourage, right, you know? He's got like Grizz and .com, and he says, "Hey, .com, let's put together a contest. That'll be a great idea." You know, you think it would be much more polished, but it is pretty sloppy to say the least, even with top level stars.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing is that it's very experimental. And you know, to be honest, I run contests or social media initiatives with my clients, and I'm learning as I go along because. You know, I can definitely make the best educated guess as possible just because of what, you know, my training and my experience. But, you know, I don't run the same contest every single time. I definitely don't run the same type of contest with different clients. Or even if I devise a Twitter strategy, I don't devise the same type of Twitter strategy across all clientele because they have different needs. They have different, you know, types of budgets. Or they have different, you know, different goals, or they have different staff resources. So, you know, you have to be flexible, but then you also have to realize that it's a learning process as well. And, you know, I at least make sure that my clients know that going in.
Well, thanks so much, Liz Burr, for sitting down and chatting with me about social media and what it means to be a new media consultant. I really appreciate your time.
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks for having me. This is great.
So you can follow Liz on Twitter at twitter.com/CaliNative, and her blog is lizburr.com. And I'll put all of those in the show notes on the site. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.